Olave gave us the spiritual connection to our ancestors and to our spiritual beliefs. And we were able to call back our gods, because it's Hawaii that we are related to and are born out of and we descend from. And so that relationship is integral to our identity as to who we are as a people.
Welcome to the Sacred Land Film Project's audio archive, where we revisit the clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we revisit our interview with historian and Native Hawaiian land protector, Deviana Pomakai McGregor. This is the second part of our interview. The sacred Hawaiian island of Kaho'olawe was taken over by the U.S. military and used as a bombing test range during World War II. But in the 1970s, a group of determined Native Hawaiians, or Kanaka Maoli, occupied the island and demanded that the military stop the bombing and return Kaho'olawe to indigenous hands. Through a determined struggle that lasted more than a decade, involving lawsuits, prayer, and the death of two activists, George Helm and Kimo Mitchell, the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana won the island back to Native Hawaiian control. We featured this hopeful story in the fourth episode of our Standing on Sacred Ground series. In 2011, I sat down with PKO leader Deviana McGregor in her office at the University of Hawaii Manoa to record the story of the struggle to win back Kaho'olawe and the ongoing efforts to heal the island both physically and spiritually. As a historian who studies Hawaii and the Pacific region, Deviana framed the story within a long arc of history and within Hawaiian cultural practices. We weren't able to include this complex background in the film, so I'm glad we can share these important details with you now. To learn more about the occupation of Kaho'olawe and the movement to win the island back, don't miss part one of our interview. In this second part of our interview, Deviana relates the history of settler colonialism and the impact of Christian missionaries as she delves into cosmology and traditional cultural practices. But first, Deviana explained how her ancestors left messages hidden in the names of places.
When you look at the land, what are all the elements surrounding it that interface and interact on that landscape? So we want to understand what are the winds and the rains that come in different seasonal phases of a year, and then how the monthly changes occur with the changing of the moon. And this is what the Hawaiians had a very intimate understanding of. So the Hawaiians looked upon the land as it was a member of their family, of their extended ohana. The Hawaiians became the ohana to the land. And the land was sort of like an elder, a cherished elder, a kupuna. And so they would care for the land in that manner. And they looked at the landscape and they gave the land names that would match the characteristic of the land. For example, the island of Kaho'olawe was originally Kanaloa. The kupuna say because when the navigators who traveled across from Hawaii to Tahiti returned and they saw this island, it was like heaven all lit up. And they called it Kohemalamalamo Kanaloa, the southern beacon of Kanaloa, because this island and the training that they had received while on the island had enabled them to safely travel south to Tahiti and then safely back and return to this island. Because the island is at the center of our chain, of our paiaina, and is the piko, this island became a place where they could train in how to look at how the heavenly bodies rise and set, and where especially Hokupa'a, the North Star, sits in relation to the Southern Cross, and to use that to safely guide them to Tahiti and back. And so they named this island Kanaloa, and we call now Kanaloa Kaho'olawe, because this is where they could come to know the nature of Kanaloa, the god of the ocean. And so for the Hawaiians, all of the elements related to Kanaloa, the ocean, the winds of the ocean, the rains, and how to travel safely across this body of Kanaloa, the ocean, all of that intimate knowledge could be gained by living on this island and training there and observing all of the elements that interface with this island. And then the other name of the island is Kohimalamalamo Kanaloa, the Shining Birth Canal of Kanaloa, which means that this is the place for Hawaiians, that the knowledge of Kanaloa was born into our culture and into our practice. So this enabled Hawaiians to understand that this island, of all the islands, was a place to go to learn to navigate. Whereas an island such as Hawaii Island, which has much more resources and has so many different features from the mountain caps of Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea to the ocean depths of the Alanui Haha Channel, it enabled the Hawaiians to live much more abundantly and it gave them a lot more resources. And it was an island where Hawaiians thrived and, you know, established larger settlements and fishing and farming. Or an island like Oahu, which is very rich in water resources, and the whole windward side is just like a taro basket for the Hawaiian people, because that's where taro flourished, because it had so many flowing streams. And you have a lot of names along that coast of Oahu which have wai in them, waiahole, waikane, because it was abundant in water, freshwater resources. So the Hawaiians named these places because they had observed over time, generations, what resources it afforded. And then based on that, they developed a land system, which we call the Ahupua'a Land Management System, which respected those resources. And so if we look at the settlement patterns, where did Hawaiians build their houses as compared to where they cultivated, then it's also a clue to us to know, well, what can the land sustain in terms of population, if we look at the extent to which there's habitation in an area, but also where is it best suited to build structures as compared to cultivating the land? Because they wanted to maximize cultivation and to leave as little a footprint on the landscape as necessary. This enabled the Hawaiians to live sustainably and to nurture the resources. Then there's also the principle related to water, to wai. And they knew that water was the principal land managing factor. Where there was a lot of water, then you could have a larger population and more cultivation. Where there were fewer water resources in areas, say, such as Kau on the island of Hawaii, you would have a larger land base supporting a smaller population because you didn't have running streams full time. You had to go to the ocean where the water would bubble up, and these springs were where the people could live because that's where the water was available. And, you know, Kau means the breast, and they're looking at this landmass, and the water is under this land that then provides the sustenance to the people. If we go to our islands today and we look at where there are kipuka, that I'm calling where the Hawaiians lived according to subsistence practices and applying traditional knowledge, such as areas like Hana or Puna, Hawaii, or here the island of Molokai, what we'll find is that these are areas that still have abundant resources, abundant ocean resources, the thriving fish that people still can harvest for subsistence purposes, and very pristine streams where there's aquatic life that people can still harvest. This is the o'opu or the opai or the hihiwai. And there's also very healthy forests that people can still gather resources from. And so where these kipuka are of Hawaiians continuing to live in a sustainable relationship to the land is really where we have our best and most pristine natural resources and cultural resources, because these are the areas that the Hawaiians cared for from generation to generation.
Taking guidance from their ancestors, who saw themselves as ohana, or family to the land, as well as direct advice from cherished kapuna, or elders, the founders of the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana organized themselves as a family, instead of a conventional activist group. Deviana helped me better understand how this concept of being a family with the land as a member of the family is embedded in the Hawaiian language.
Ohana is an extended family, and it's multi-generational, from the Kupuna, our grandparents, to the Makua, the parent generation, and the Opio, the younger generations, and then the Kamali'i, the children and toddlers and such. And it's also a spiritual dimension. It's inclusive of the family members who have passed on, who we honor as our aumakua, our family guardians. So it is inclusive of those who have passed on, and also it's inclusive of those who are yet to come. When you think as an ohana, you're thinking of how do we provide for generations who are yet to be born.
Getting non-Indigenous people to see Kaho'olawe as a sacred place, to understand it as a wahipana, or storied place, has long been one of the biggest and most crucial challenges facing the PKO. And again, there is a hidden message in the name of Kaho'olawe.
Kaho'olawe being a wahipana is a recognition that it was named after a god and a deity, and that embodies that god. So it elevates Kaho'olawe as a very important sacred place, because it's the only place throughout the Pacific that's named after a god. So that makes it very special and distinct.
Hawaiians look to the natural world for guidance as to how best protect and revive this special island.
In the volcanic rainforest, when Pele goes through and erupts and covers the land with lava, she also leaves behind these oases or little islands of full-growth forest, from the tall koa trees and ohia trees to the small ferns and the spores. And then gradually from these oases of life come the seeds for the regeneration of the forest, or the lava once it's cooled. And so these kipuka, or what the Hawaiians call kipuka, are very important for the regeneration of the forest after the lava has come through. If you go through our rainforest in the volcano area, it's a mosaic of old-growth forest with new-growth forest, and at all different stages because of this. Throughout our islands, if we look at how social change occurred, you have the mainstream of political and economic change going through the islands and really transforming the landscapes, as well as the cultural and social practices of Native Hawaiians. In many areas where there were port towns or where the plantations developed. But we also have small rural communities that are isolated, that didn't have good harbors, that wasn't sufficient for large-scale plantation development. And they remain as cultural kipuka for our Native Hawaiian culture and practices. And these kipuka are very important for us as Native Hawaiians today, when we want to go back to look at what was our culture like and how can we better learn our cultural customs and practices, to go to these kipuka, because this is where generations of Hawaiians continued to live and live by farming and fishing. And because they were doing it pretty much at a subsistence level, isolated from the modern amenities that everybody else had, that they continued to apply the indigenous knowledge to make them successful farmers and fishermen. So they observed, you know, how to plant by the moon phase, how to fish by the changing seasons from wet to dry. And because of this, they continued to speak Hawaiian and to live the indigenous way of life and to apply that indigenous knowledge to their day-to-day lives. In the case of Kaho'olawe, it's an area that Hawaiians were unable to live on once the military took it over during World War II. And so from World War II until the Protect Lawe Ohana started to come back, the island was really not occupied and cared for and nurtured by Native Hawaiians. And so when the ohana began to come back and to reclaim the island, we drew a lot from the Hawaiians who had lived in these kipuka, our elders especially, our kupuna, from Hana and from Kanai on Maui, or from Puna and Kau on Hawaii Island, or from here on Molokai. We drew from the kupuna from all these different islands to come and share their cultural knowledge as to how can we revive the natural and cultural resources of Koho'olawe and make Koho'olawe into a new kipuka for our culture, where generations in the future can come and get in touch and connect with the land and the spirit of the land, and to learn and practice Hawaiian culture in this pu'uhonua, or this reserve that's set aside for Native Hawaiian people.
This perfect metaphor of kipuka, a biological refuge from which seeds can regenerate a devastated environment, as well as a cultural refuge in which traditional knowledge survived the assault of colonialism, is so appropriate. And for Native Hawaiians to revive those places of power and significance is a practical challenge.
In these kipuka, the people who live there, I call them kua'aina, the people who are the backbone of the land. In these kipuka, the kua'aina lived in a sustainable relationship with the land and the natural resources. And so that's a lesson for all of us who live on islands especially, but people who also live on continents, that we need to live in a sustainable relationship with the land and its resources and take care of and nurture these resources, that if we do only a sustainable harvest, only take as much water as is given to us on an annual basis, and really just strive to have a sustainable use of all of these important resources, that this is the way that we will survive and that we will pass on to future generations a way of life that they can thrive in. Otherwise, we're going to destroy our planet, and we won't be able to allow the future generations to make that connection with the land, with the spirit of the land, or be able to sustain themselves from these resources.
Deviana explained how Christian missionaries who arrived in Hawaii in 1820 challenged and frequently destroyed this sustainable lifestyle.
When Christianity was introduced to Hawaii, the focus then became humans and, you know, an afterlife. And it really did not focus on continuing this relationship between humans and the land and nurturing that relationship. And it also enabled the society to commodify the land and to change it into a system of private land ownership and buying and selling the land. So that further alienated the Hawaiian people from this historic relationship to the land. And that relationship was broken, and it really wasn't until Koho'olawe and the whole call to Aloha Aina that we as Hawaiians in my generation began to really connect back to the land and the spiritual nature of the land. And by honoring again our gods, such as Lono of the Makahiki, when the Makahiki on Koho'olawe was first observed again in 1980, this was the first time that in modern day the full ceremony was practiced, and we begin that reconnection of the Hawaiian to our spiritual soul as a people. Because Christianity had severed that relationship of our soul to the land, because it focused on our soul in relationship to an abstract entity, which is good, but it still didn't enable us to keep and nurture and honor our relationship as humans to the land and the spirit of the land, which is really the heart and soul of our culture as a people and our identity as a people here in Hawaii. Because it's Hawaii that we are related to and are born out of and we descend from. And so that relationship is integral to our identity as to who we are as a people. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, we're really looking at humans conquering nature and invoking the spiritual entity to help humans overcome obstacles in nature and control these forces of nature, to harness these forces of nature, to be able to advance technologically in a materialist fashion, and to use the land and its resources for generating profit in the capitalist system. Ultimately, the land and all resources are commodities, and everything that is commodified can then be bought and sold, and it is depersonalized. But the way that Christianity enables us to do that is you see this importance of using God to harness the forces of nature rather than to place ourselves as humans in a respectful relationship to nature and to better understand and observe the changing dynamics of geology and geographic forces, and how can we as humans better adapt to these changes in nature. We are very small in relation to the magnificence of all our natural resources, and Hawaiians honored the life forces of nature and these various energy forms as deities because they realized that only these natural life forms create something out of nothing, whereas humans, we're able to reproduce humans, but we're not able to just create something new out of nothing, whereas nature has that life force that enables nature to reproduce and to regenerate and to revitalize. There's so many awesome and magnificent forces. The force of the volcano is a tremendous life force that you can't deny exists and that humans cannot really control. They may want to, but you really can't control Pele. When she wants to go and take the land back, then you have to honor that and respect that. But in a Judeo-Christian sense, the idea is to try to control it. You know, in the past, they even tried to bomb the volcano to change its path, and yet they didn't succeed. Ultimately, Pele proved to be more powerful than that, more magnificent. Even in our Hawaiian traditions, if we look at the original Hawaiians who settled here and began to develop a relationship with Hawaii, and you have it over centuries where Hawaiians came from Polynesia and they brought with them their Polynesian beliefs and their practices. But over centuries, it's believed at least five centuries, six centuries here, you know, from 600, say, to 1100, 1200, you have an indigenous belief system that evolves out of a relationship with the resources in Hawaii. And our beliefs then are really tied to honoring these different natural forces, Pele, the volcanic dynamics of the volcanic system and the eruptive forces, or Kane and the movement of the sun across the sky on a daily and annual basis in conjunction with Kanaloa, and observations that Hawaiians made all here in Hawaii that began to understand nature at its different levels and the spiritual essence of these life forces.
So often, indigenous history gets simplified into before contact and after contact. As a historian, Deviana has researched what happened during the hundreds of years after Tahitians arrived in the Hawaiian Islands, followed then by the coming of the Christian missionaries, and how the Hawaiian people's relationship to place evolved through those centuries, as their original nature-based religion evolved through two waves of settler conquest, from nature-based to human-centered.
So you have this original indigenous belief system that was really nature-tied. We made hokupu and offerings to all of our nature deities and honored the changing seasons. And then there's a disjuncture when Paao comes from Tahiti and he introduces a different belief system that is organized around certain gods and these images or the ki'i forms of these gods. And a state religion develops that links chiefs as the human form of these deities and the honoring of these deities that are, you know, these images, the ku, the lono, the kane, but it is, in a way, removing this honoring of a god from the natural form and all the forms we see around us and trying to embody it in this ki'i or this image or in the embodiment of a chief. And so that begins even within the Hawaiian system to change the emphasis away from nature itself to this human kind of religion, focusing on the role of the divine chief And it's linked to the development of a governance structure that is also around this all-knowing, all-powerful chief. So even in that Hawaiian system, you have some intermediary between the Hawaiian and nature itself through this form of the chief. And then when the chiefs decide to abandon that system of belief where that you have the divine chief, they also embrace Christianity, which then removes the Hawaiian further and that belief system further from nature to now this all-powerful being that is also associated with an entirely new way of life and a whole new civilization. And that to honor this deity and to be godlike, you have to really abandon your cultural practices and lifestyle. You have to engage in farming that's not traditional. You have to live in a house that's not natural. You have to wear clothes that now requires you to go out and get money to engage in a market economy in order to clothe yourself and to feed your family. So it further enables this separation of Hawaiians from nature because you're no longer honoring nature as deity, but as a commodity also, that it puts you into this nexus of a more capitalist system and a market economy that was being imposed by the chiefs engaging in this trade with the foreigners.
Deviana explained how the next radical transformation of culture in Hawaii began when the islands were subjected to the dynamics of world trade and the demands of global capitalism, which eventually led to Hawaii being the U.S. Navy's central command base in the Pacific Ocean.
The Cook voyage is significant, not because it's the first European contact, but because it's the European contact that opens Hawaii to a market system and a world system of trade. And so in the first phase, you have the fur traders coming, which links Hawaii to this search on the part of America to open up the trade with China. And Hawaii gets drawn into this American trade with China by providing a resting place at first for ships engaged in getting furs from the Indians from North America. And then subsequently finding that sandalwood is prized in China, then Hawaii became a place to harvest sandalwood for the China trade by the Americans. Then as the sandalwood trade declines, next you have whaling. And whaling comes out of New England. And so with the whalers come the missionaries out of New England to bring this Presbyterian Calvinist belief system, which is very, very strict among any of the Christian practices. And with whaling, you have now three kinds of resident foreigners, the whaling captains and sailors, the missionaries who come to pretty much advocate for a marketing system by saying that in order to be Christian, you have to adapt the lifestyle of the Westerner by wearing formal clothing and living in frame houses and changing your farming practices to produce what's needed for the trade rather than what has been the traditional Hawaiian subsistence crops. Hawaiians begin to have to engage in cash crop production. And then the third element are the merchants, who then are bringing manufactured goods primarily still out of New England and then taking the whale oil back to New England and selling it there. So these three, the whalers, the merchants, the missionaries, is the foundation for a capitalist economy in Hawaii. And as they need to establish this capitalist economy, they need to really transform the Hawaiian social system. They need a system of private property ownership, not communal and ohana family use of and stewardship of land. They need a wage labor system, not an ohana system where people are work for each other. They need really a governance structure that will enable the transformation from this communal land system to a private property land system. And ultimately, a wage labor system that will enable them to go to faraway lands in China and Japan and even in Europe to bring the workers that will establish agricultural capitalist system based on sugar production. And so sugar in the 1860s replaces whaling. And by then you have had a transformation of the governance structure to be like that of Britain, a republic, and a governance structure which the Hawaiian chiefs themselves don't really know how to manage. And so even though it's a constitutional monarchy that still acknowledges a king and a monarch, the power really begins to shift toward a cabinet and the legislature. And this is where the chiefs realize they have to rely on foreigners to conduct business and to even conduct governance day to day. And so this is the way in which foreigners get into the governance structure, enabling them to make laws that establish a private property system, wage labor system, and an immigration of contract labor for the plantations. The Hawaiians trust in this system because the Hawaiian chiefs are really being threatened with the takeover of the governance by the merchants or the traders operating in the islands, bringing in foreign gunboats to bring pressure to give special trading privileges and privileges of private land ownership. And they turn to the missionaries as the men of God, who they believe to be morally upright and just, to advise them as to what is the best manner to work with these foreign governments and foreign traders. And so they've developed this loyalty and reliance upon the missionaries, who then begin to play roles as they leave the mission role. They enter into governance and into the business of capital plantation development in the islands. To secure this market, ultimately, it requires incorporation into the United States. I mean, they try to work trade treaties in order to overcome tariff structures that are meant to protect American sugar businesses. But ultimately, it's only incorporation into the United States that resolves their market problem and makes the sugar industry profitable. And America, at the time that the Hawaiian sugar growers are seeking a relationship with the United States for their business interests, America, United States itself, is seeking to expand its role in the Pacific and again into the China trade, but not so much to acquire goods from China as it had been in the 18th century, but this time developing a trade with China as a market for goods that are now being overproduced in America. So by the 1880s, the United States is the third largest producer of industrial products in the world and also a major producer of agricultural goods. But it has a crisis of overproduction. And the only way to resolve this crisis of overproduction is to find new markets overseas. And so you have the militarist strategist Theodore Mahan and Theodore Roosevelt coming up with this idea that the United States needs to have a great navy in order to have markets overseas. And this great navy will need to have coaling stations throughout the oceans of the world. And so they come up with a strategy to maintain an open door with China and to acquire overseas colonies that are island-based to provide coaling stations for a navy. And then finally to construct the Panama Canal to link the Atlantic with the Pacific and to make the trade with China go faster. So Hawaii becomes central to this strategy of the United States for imperialist expansion and its overseas markets, in that it provides one of the key military bases at Pu'uloa, or Pearl Harbor. And the other key link is the Philippines, and Hawaii becomes central as a naval base when the United States attempts to take over the Philippines and they run into armed resistance and the Philippine-American War, which extends from 1898 into 1910 or so. And a lot of that initial war with the Philippines is staged out of Hawaii, as we see later in the Vietnam War. Whatever wars the United States is engaged in Asia is staged from what is a secure base for America in Hawaii. So the military begins to build up more so in the 30s as Japan is a major force in Asia, especially when Japan defeats Russia. This is a huge setback for Russia and Europe and the United States all feel very threatened by this rising force in Japan. And there's military buildup in Hawaii to begin to prepare against Japan's military force. And we see that, you know, in fact, with December 7th, you know, 1941, Japan does consider Hawaii to be such a major center of U.S. power that it feels it can cripple the U.S. Navy by bombing all of the ships that are anchored at Pearl Harbor, which actually draws the United States into World War II. So the military, since the 30s and all throughout World War II, has been a major force in Hawaii as well as Pacific, and mainly because as the United States begins to look to a new relationship with Japan and China and Asia, Hawaii continues to play this major role both as a military center, but also as a base for financial expansion into the Asia and Pacific region.
But ultimately, as we documented in our Standing on Sacred Ground series, the native Hawaiians stopped the bombing of their sacred island, won Kaho'olawe back from military control, and set it aside as an island of sanctuary and a place for the practice of traditional Hawaiian culture.
The main character in the whole story about the history of Kaho'olawe is the land itself. It is the centerpiece of our involvement in the whole struggle to stop the bombing. And so we have had many leaders come and very many people get involved with our ohana, take their experience to their own home islands and such. But the constant factor and the constant central character in all of this is the land itself, is the island itself. It's the island who's calling us to come and get involved. It's the island who's appealing to us to come and help her heal. And it's the island who establishes this relationship that we each feel. Each of us have our own special connection to the island. When you go to the island, it's for you to hear what voice it awakens within you. I mean, the voice is there. It's just that the island affords us that opportunity for it to awaken. And through all of the struggles, the history from going from being under the military and the transitions and transformations to the land from the ranching times and such, and now this whole revival of the island, it really is the island that is the main life force. You know, when the control of access to the island was turned over, we had plans to go and do ceremonies at different places on the island to honor this event. And the island didn't allow us to do that. A few people went over early. I think it was 14 people but were able to go over early, but the rest of us were going to come later. And the island closed out. And we had been talking about this changeover as a huli'au, we call it. It's a revolving changing of the time, a changing of the era. And it's an upheaval. And how were we going to honor this changeover? And the island did it itself. You know, it's like, there's this big windstorm, the dust came, the island was enclosed in itself, and, you know, it was an overturning, but it kind of went through an experience all by itself, and those people who were there, the 14 who made it, were just in awe of what they experienced. And so there are times when the island takes on a life of its own, it always has life, and there's times when we have to come and make things happen, but a lot it's the island itself that's moving things forward and directing us what is needed in the next period of time.
Daviana and other members of the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana have learned to use oli, Hawaiian chants, to communicate with the land.
For our oli, we have the chants that were given to us by our ancestors, which relate what they observed in their time and celebrate the moods and character and life of the island in their lifetime. And then there are the oli that our contemporaries have composed to help bridge ourselves going from the secular to the sacred. So some of the protocols and the chants that we do, such as the landing chant, is recognizing that we're coming from a secular world and we're entering now into a sacred realm. And we have to somehow be able to bridge that. and physically and spiritually make that reconnection. And then we go through a cleansing when we're on the island. We go through a kapukai. We go into the ocean and we spend a period of time so that we can release whatever things that were distractions to us and problems to us when we were outside in the secular realm, and leave that and let it wash away, so that in our time on the island, we're focused and it's our time with the island itself, so we can open our heart and our minds and our soul to what is there. And we can also focus with each other on a common purpose and leave whatever other distractions and differences outside. So that's the other way in which this enables us. And then there are other chants that we've composed to begin to record our own experiences with the island and what the island gives us as an experience, be it in a sign of a cloud form or the rains at a certain time or even the washing away of the soil and the erosion and then the coming back to life, and what are the different insects and plants that come at different times of year. We begin to, you know, also record this in our own lifetimes. So the island gives us those experiences, and we can give voice to them through composing our own oli and keep that continuing on.
Just as Deviana is now interpreting the hidden messages her ancestors left in place names and chants, it's significant that the current Ohana members are leaving messages for their descendants in the new chants they write. And throughout it all, the elders, the kapuna, have been key to protecting and reviving these cultural practices.
We are very fortunate as an Ohana to have the Edith Kanaka Ole Foundation. They have a tradition where they have been the keepers of the knowledge of the Pele traditions, but also of the broader religious and cultural practices and beliefs. They've studied the chants. They, more than anyone, understand that the chants have knowledge that our ancestors encoded, that has the knowledge that they had collected over generations and are now passing it on to the next generation through these encoded chants. And you need to have a knowledge of the language to then know what the chants mean. But you need to have the broader cultural and religious knowledge in order to really understand the deep hidden meanings in these chants. And so the ability of the Edith Kanaka Ole Foundation, which is multi-generational also, delving into this knowledge of our chants, such as the Kumulipo, and beginning to reconstruct what is the meaning and understanding of it, has really begun to enable us to understand how can we expand this knowledge base. So for example, the Kanaka Ole Foundation has gone to the Kumulipo, which is a chant that documents the evolution of life and different eras and different stages. This is thousands of lines in the chant. And the 13th era speaks of Papa the Earth Mother and Papa Hulilani, Papa Hulihonua, and Papa Hanaumoku. And what they have been able to understand from this is that this person, Papa, at that time was attributed in helping to organize the knowledge of Hawaiians into three schools of thought, three schools of science. The Papa Hulilani, the knowledge of the heavens and from the clouds and out into the universe, and the constellations and the movement of the sun, the changing of the seasons, the movements of the moon and the changes to the tides. The Papa Hulihonua, the knowledge of the earth and volcanism and the tides, the oceans, the interface of the landscape with the oceans and the elements, rain, formation of valleys and canyons, all of the geological forces. And then Papa Hanaumoku is all living things and things that reproduce and give birth. And so we've worked with them to say, here on our sacred island, as a cultural reserve, what is it that we need to do? What are the activities that we should be engaging in to be good stewards of a sacred place? We should look upon a sacred place as a place where we can engage and experience the universe as our ancestors did, and be able to then expand upon this ancestral knowledge. So here is a place that is isolated, that has only a few buildings on one side of the island, but for the most part, it's just natural elements, abused and which needs to be revitalized. But you have an opportunity to be there in a place where it's just you and all the elements surrounding you. And you have a chance to observe, as our ancestors did, the heavens and the seasons, and to reconstruct sites on the land that helped in observing the changing seasons. And also to look at the sites that are already there that were left by our ancestors and understand how these sites were constructed to assist our ancestors in doing these scientific observations of the sun and the solstices and the equinoxes, and how as the sun moves from one to the other phase, that it changes the whole elemental forms on the earth. Being on the land, then we're better able to understand the natural processes that occur on the land. And as we're beginning to bring the island back to life, we need to remove invasive species and bring back the native species. One thing we have to do, for example, is get rid of the mice and the cats that are on the island, so that our native birds, which are mostly seabirds out on an island such as Koholave, and our ground nesting birds can then make their nests and raise their young without the predators. And then we can understand, how do we begin to bring back these native birds to the island and recreate a native ecology that our ancestors observed, because that was the ecology that they lived in? What are the plants that best thrive on an island like Koholave, so that when we choose what we plant, they have success? We look at the chance. You know, we know pili grass was on the island and different other dryland plants. And geologically, in the realm of plants and such, we can look to the surrounding islands, because Koholave geologically is related to Maui and Lanai, and understand what's happening on those islands to inform us about what goes on in Koholave, but also what kind of plants grow, for example, on Lanai, which is in the same rain shadow as Koholave is from Haleakala, and to see the kind of plants that are successful there would be successful on Koholave. It really is important to try to understand our indigenous knowledge base and access our indigenous knowledge base effectively and meaningfully, that we can draw upon that indigenous knowledge base, but then in our own observations begin to validate and expand upon that. So Hawaiians, for example, have these olelo no'ea, or wise sayings, which show parallel growths of, for example, they say, when the hala, or the pandanus tree, is blossoming, when there's flowers on the pandanus tree, then the vana is ripe and the he'e is, you know, reproducing. And they had observed that at this season, when both things happen, and, you know, so if we begin to observe these forms of life, then we can begin to also have our own sayings that reflect our growing base of knowledge. So this is important, and it is also what we're using as a planning tool for how do we reestablish Koholave as a sacred place, and how do we involve and engage Hawaiians and other people from Hawaii in this practice, and respect why Koholave is a sacred place, and the meaning of that and the importance of that to understanding life and evolution and life systems and the earth, and how can we then be better stewards and live in a more sustainable manner in our island ecosystems.
In trying to be good stewards of Koholave, while always taking into account the spiritual dimension, perhaps the biggest ecological challenge for Native practitioners is water.
For us to be successful in being a steward of the island in a physical way and in a spiritual way, which is captured in our Hawaiian word kahu'aina, which means a spiritual caretaker and steward of a place and of a people, that it's important that we draw upon the technology and the advances that are available to us from botany and biology and agronomics and such. And we know what materials we have available to us to create an area where the plants can thrive. You know, so our situation is we have hard pan. There's no soil. So it's not a simple matter that you could just go plant something. We have no water. There's no running water on the island. In the atomic era, the military decided to test what's the impact of an atomic bomb blast on ships that are anchored near shore. And so they blasted 500 tons of TNT on the southwestern point of the island where they had ships offshore, and then they had cameras situated to record the vibrations and record what happened. And so this huge explosion left a very deep hole, and hydrologists that we've brought over believe that it cracked the island so that water continues to leak out from the water table into the ocean. The hole that was dug is very deep, and it has water in it that's brackish, so it has obviously water coming in from the ocean and fresh water coming in from the water lens. And because it's cracked and leaking like that, we're not sure how we can establish a long-term water table. We know there is a water table. We're not sure how deep the fresh water lens is, and we don't want to begin to tap into it until we're sure we have recharge capacity. So until the land is planted and we have the ability to have recharge and not the water just running off, we don't want to really explore how deep that fresh water lens is. But we know fresh water is leaking into the ocean and that hole that was made by the big blast. So we have to be creative in how to capture water that comes from the heavens, the rainfall. Let's take rain, for example. The water is essential for the plants to grow. We need to have a reservoir of water that can provide water to the plants year-round, because we don't have a water table to draw upon to provide that. So we have to know how to construct a catchment system that will be functional, that will go into a tank, and then how do we have an irrigation network that'll function even when we're not there. And then you have to have the solar system to run the pump when we're not there and putting it on a timer. There's all these really technical things you need to know to in order to get the water to the plants so that they can live. But how do we get the rain there is the other question. And so this is also where, as Hawaiians, we know traditionally that there was a rain cloud that would bring daily the rain that helped the gardens of our ancestors flourish. And that rain cloud would form on Haleakala, the forest of Haleakala, and then build up and come over to Koholawe and drench the land there and then continue on to Lanai and then even to Molokai, this great aoloa, this long cloud, and a lay of cloud. But because of changes on Haleakala, there's no forest, there's pasture land, so the cloud doesn't form as much as it had traditionally. And so it doesn't make its way over to Koholawe. And so one of the things we did was we went into our tradition and working with Hokulani Holt from Maui, she decided and advised and oversaw the construction of what we call a rain koa, to send the rain from Haleakala to Koholawe and a rain koa to receive the rain, to try to encourage and entice the elements to come back to give us that cloud formation that will bring the rain to the island. And on an annual basis, we know that the main rains that come that replenish our water table are the Makahiki rains of Lono. And so we do the Lono ceremonies to call those rains to come in that season from October through March. And we've tried to balance and interweave the technical with the spiritual knowledge and practices so that we can have the island come back to life, give these plants a chance to live.
The PKO organizes groups of volunteers to help heal the island. Daviana says many of the native Hawaiian volunteers have told her that the island speaks to them and gives them a deeper sense of being Hawaiian.
One time we brought a group of women who had been battered and abused, you know, and they were going through a training because they had turned to drugs because of this. And I remember they're saying, you know, the island looked like how they felt. You know, the island was a battered woman and it was bleeding. And they could see the wounds were still fresh. And you could see when it rains, it bleeds out into the ocean. And they felt that connection, but they also felt this empowerment to heal the island. The island also was beginning to heal. It was opening up and it was healing, and that they could heal too. And that in working to help the island heal, that they themselves began to heal. And we've had that experience with a lot of groups that come. They come with feeling of being hurt in some way, economically, socially, within the school system, especially those people who are hurting. This visual of the island that's been abused, still struggling and living and thriving and opening up her arms to have you come and live with her for these moments and embracing you while you're there. And you just feel so connected to the island that you sympathize with the island that it's been abused. You want to heal it. And then the surprise is you become healed yourself. Hawaiians are the most abused people in Hawaii, in our homeland. You know, we're beaten down every day. No, you can't control your own land. No, you folks are the highest rates of people in prison. You know, most people proportionately on welfare. You folks don't have, you know, enough college graduates. I mean, we're put down how many ways? But then when you come to this island and you say, well, you know, there's a sense of dignity you can still have through this kind of abuse. You still have your dignity as a person, and you can strive to overcome. And I think the way to strive to overcome is begin to work as a family of Hawaiians, to heal ourselves as a people and to heal our resources, and begin gradually as we heal as a family to also better nurture these resources to continue the process of healing and supporting our people overall.
In the decades since this interview, I've been honored to witness Daviana and the PKO laboring diligently with deep integrity to heal both the island and the Ohana. Their approach and their work brings me so much hope. You can listen to more of my interview with Daviana Pomakai McGregor in part one of our conversation, where Davy shares the full story of how the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana won their island back into Native Hawaiian hands. You'll find that episode at sacredland.org, along with our full audio archive, as well as films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt Wong and Toby McLeod. Our interview with Daviana was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger, along with co-producer Jessica Abbey. This episode is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in Lejeune, Ohlone Territory in Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.